If people are dieting now more than ever, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs, or medium-chain triglycerides, are unique compounds that can be easily converted into ketones and provide an efficient fuel source for your body, thereby enhancing your energy production potential. Instead of turning into fat when you consume them, MCTs turn into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. MCT Wellness is Dr. Gundry's polyphenol-rich MCT powder aimed at boosting your body's fat-burning capacity. What's amazing is this energy boost can be felt quickly. It doesn't take months or years to make a difference. It's also very easy to add to your routine. There are 3 great flavors to choose from, and you just add a scoop of MCT Wellness to some water or your favorite drink and enjoy. So if you want to experience a quick and effective boost to your metabolic potential, go to GundryMD.com/mindful and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/mindful. Let's be real. Eating healthy can be a hassle. Stressing about nutrition, planning meals, shopping for ingredients. What if there was an easier way? Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your door. Each week, you can choose from a brand new selection of quick and easy meal kit recipes with a wide variety of dietary options, plus dozens of snacks, salads, breakfast items, and more. You can pick and choose from recipe options like vegetarian, Mediterranean, carb conscious, the list goes on. My family tested out the sirloin steak and the salmon last week, and it was a big winner at the dinner table. All of Sunbasket's meal kits are quick and easy, even if you're not a pro in the kitchen. Thanks to Sunbasket's commitment to clean ingredients and organic fresh produce, there's no easier way to eat your very best. Go to sunbasket.com/mindful today to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/mindful to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. Hello, everyone. Les Raymond here with the Mindful Movement. I am happy to have Patrick McAndrew, the founder and CEO of Hire, with me today on the podcast. Patrick, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast.
Pleasure to be here, Les.
I'm interested to hear what this Hire is about. You guys have sent some info our way, and it's fascinating. I would love to hear a little bit of the origin story, too, of how you came about to bring this to fruition.
Yeah, so
maybe you could.
Yeah, it started in about 2020. I launched the Momentum Mind Academy, and that was born out of work that I'd been doing before that, where I was teaching speed reading and memorization workshops around the US, high schools, universities, companies. And I saw that everywhere I went, there were these fractured minds. So there were these really ambitious and driven people. But what happened is because I was teaching them about essentially how their brain worked in relation to reading and in relation to memory, it would open up a lot of other conversations that they wanted to discuss about what they were feeling inside. And just overwhelmingly, I could see that people had a clear sense of what they wanted to get to. But the greatest frustration that they felt was putting themselves on the path to move towards that. They felt like they were their own greatest obstacle. And a big part of that was their attention. They couldn't seem to hold their attention on the thing that they actually wanted to do. So in truth, I was experiencing the same thing, as well as running the teaching the speed reading memorization courses. I had another business in New York. It was an audio marketing business. We did campaigns for Spotify. And I could go into the office and I could be in there from 8 a.m. and I mightn't get anything meaningful done until about 3 p.m. until the pressure was on me. And then I'd be in there until 8 or 9 and I'd miss out on activities I thought I was going to do that evening or people I was going to meet. And I kind of tell myself, tomorrow's going to be different. I'm going to be much more disciplined and I'm not going to get so distracted. I'm not going to be so taken by my impulses and my cravings. But it would repeat again. So I stopped doing the speed reading work. I stopped everything I did. I closed down the agency and I just poured into this for about 5 months to understand. The question that I was curious to explore was, what is focus? And why is it so difficult in this day and age to focus? That led me on a journey for 3 years, running the Momentum Mind Academy, working with a lot of companies, running leadership programs and also programs with their sales teams. And the thing that I came to notice, it changed about July last year, was that I could help people become better taskmasters to sort of get things done, but it wasn't developing them as human beings. They were just sort of becoming more machine-like. They were just learning how to just get more things done. And at the end of the day, they didn't know how to spend any time with themselves. They didn't know how to be with themselves.
Patrick, if I recall, you were talking about that your clientele was getting better at like the machine operation of task, of accomplishing tasks, but they didn't understand how to spend time with themselves.
Yeah, it sort of like made like life needing to be this whole effort towards being productive. And being productive was just to keep like getting through tasks, getting things done. And I realized that I didn't necessarily want to be the person who was contributing towards this. I wanted to give people these skills and these capacities so that they could control and own their attention, but ultimately so that they could play a bigger and better game of life and business, not just becoming one person who gets things done, but rather feeling like what they're doing is aligned with them, is aligned with the way that they want to be with their family, the things that they want to develop in themselves. So a lot of the information that we see that's out there, especially on the internet in relation to business, is a very much externalized view of ourselves. That if we can create this sort of externalized view of hitting material targets, we will feel fulfilled. And I just saw over and over again that that was not the case. So Hara was born out of this desire to help people be more anchored in what they're doing, because to go out on your own path and create your own business or lead a team is an incredible endeavor, and it can lead to incredible ways of discovering and developing yourself if you're allowed to bring all of those parts to yourself to it. If you're just limiting it just to try and get better and better at being productive and getting things done, you'll get that, but you'll also find that many other parts of yourself are underdeveloped after you've moved through this whole journey of life. So that's what the effort and intent of HARA is.
That sounds great. So it's generally for business owners?
There's primarily within the network that we have, it's business owners, business leaders, some creatives. So that is the intent at the moment, that it's best fit really for people who are carrying that weight of responsibility. And how do you use it? What do you use it to what effect?
Gotcha. That sounds fantastic. Yeah, I mean, so many things you just said resonated with me in so many different ways. My wife, Sarah, and I, we have multiple businesses, one being online. And, you know, part of it is just the structure of the culture and the societal pressures that that exist that we like emerge within as we get older. But there's like hamster wheels everywhere you look, or potential hamster wheels. And what we find, Sarah and I are nice that we complement each other in certain ways. She has great insights and instincts of what would be beneficial from a business standpoint. And then, but without me saying, but is that what you want to do? Is that what you want to be doing with your, like, it, even if something is a great idea and would work, doesn't mean you should do it. Like, you have to, and because of these pressures and like, oh, well, we did this and it put out this outcome, these numbers, but if we do this, it'll be these numbers, where there might be fear associated without, of not doing something because numbers might fall. And it's so easy. It's such a slippery slope to get to a place where you're no longer doing what you want to do.
Yeah, very much so. I wrote about this yesterday on my Substack about, I was preparing for a keynote talk I'm giving this weekend. And in the research that I was doing, I just was curious to see what's this word optimize is so common in our language today. Was it always common? And Google has this n-gram viewer where you can track the usage of words over time. So it was around 1960, around the mid-1960s, where the usage of optimize just shot up. And it's very interesting because it very much so maps to Moore's law, which is that the the rate of computer processing power will double every year. And as you see that, that's why the kind of curve of technology is this exponential curve. And now it's increasing even more with AI and the capacity of computer processing that's happening there. But there's no doubt that the tools that we interface with, the primary tools that we interface with, will shape how we perceive the world and how we perceive ourselves. And the internet is the poster child of optimization. It works very well with optimization. You are best served to create something that's half-baked and then iterate on it, then to and put it out, get feedback, iterate, keep going through that process. And then after four or five rounds of iterations, then you'll come to the very good thing. Instead of sort of being in your own space and trying to craft this magical piece and then putting it out there. That would be something that would have been more used, say, in a craftsperson, you know, crafting ceramics or wood or whatnot. They would hone that piece and then they would bring it out to the people who might appreciate it. In the internet, it's about like just making, putting it out, iterating, then getting data based on how people are engaging with it, letting that data inform the future decision of what you're going to do next time. And that's the system of how the mechanism works really well. But we start to internalize that in terms of that's the mechanism that works well for us. So we end up trying to optimize our hormones, optimize our sleep, optimize our relationships, optimize our time, optimize our money. And you can start to see how this language enters into the culture, not because that's the path that humans are going towards, but that our consciousness kind of gets shaped by the tools. And what's analogous to this also that I was thinking about was in the time of Jesus, the parable or the metaphor of the shepherd and his flock was used a lot in relation to God and his followers. It's no surprise that that was used at that time because to be a shepherd was a very common occupation. So because it was a common occupation of that time, they were just using and drawing from the sort of closest metaphor of analogy to something that was sort of abstract. And when the world gets confusing, we can end up starting to think that we are machine-like because we're interfacing with these machines all the time. But in fact, we're not. We're not actually machine-like. We've just only been existing in this world with machines for the last 60 years.
We're not machine-like yet.
Yeah. Or it's not in our nature.
Not yet.
Yeah. How do you think things are going on this path, Les?
I am stubborn in those ways. I understand that people collectively have, or I hope, the romantic in me hopes that we still have one foot rooted in the more, I don't know, what is what I would consider more natural and connected to nature. And there's a big part of me that fights technology. But if we make the technology, I could see the argument that what's unnatural about that? And my instinct is to fight that. And I know in my head, I have a history of creating maybe unnecessary suffering, analyzing those relationships or that paradox or whatever. It might be a losing battle for me, and it might be the wrong question to be considering. I don't know. I can't imagine 1,000 years from now, if there's something people like walking the earth, that it resembles the people now. But there's a major part of me, and I practice this because I don't like being on the computer. Like after this interview, I will go outside and reset my eyes and I won't want to look at a computer for the rest of the day. I wake up, I'm barefoot in the sun, in the woods or on the lawn, and I go out of my way to avoid technology. I still get grabbed my attention. I mean, you talk about distraction and attention and focus. I will fall down those technology like rabbit holes, if you will, where time seems to get away from you. But yeah, there's part of me that I don't know if it's like an old fashioned component that is somewhere in my hard wiring. But yeah, I think everybody would be better off if they spent more time outside and away from technology and with each other. But it might be a made up problem in my head and a losing battle.
No, I don't think so. You know, something that I've been offering in, because sometimes after I give a keynote talk, I'll do a workshop as well. And if it's in person or if it's online, a little practice that I have for people is just to stand still in their feet with their eyes closed for just 3 minutes. I let them know it's just going to be 3 minutes. That's all. And overwhelmingly, the feedback from those that I speak to who are in those circumstances primarily coming from a corporate audience, they just want it to be over as quickly as possible. The first...
toughest part of their day.
First 45, 60 seconds. They just want it to be done. And the reason why we start with that is because it's a clear indication of something much deeper. That if I am so uncomfortable in my own body and it's so full of agitation, I will draw my senses anywhere but into myself. So I will actually engage in a very fragmented and sort of chaotic lived experience because I don't know how to inhabit myself. So I will want to have five or six things going on, but yet over on top of that, the narrative will be, why can't I just do the thing that I need to do? And then we will place the blame on the tools and we will place the blame on all of these things. But I really think that the antidote to it is to be in our bodies. And for that, we need to be given certain access points to get in there. So once we start with that of realizing that it's very difficult for people to be standing, then we need to have them in a way of stillness, but with their eyes open and engaging in something that they're looking at. I have a stick over here and we, you know, do a lot of hand balancing activities. And that's great as a way to sort of stabilize the mind, because now I don't have to close my eyes and go internally. I can actually be present looking at the stick, and it's a wet test, because if the stick falls and hits the ground, it's because my attention left and I started thinking about something else. So you set people for a challenge to work their way up to holding that for 60 seconds without it falling. That's a wonderful way for people to suddenly start getting into their body. And naturally, it sort of creates the dependency on technology starts to ease itself, where I become less and less dependent. Because when I was running the Momentum Mind program, I was giving all of these insights and data and scientific knowledge, but it wasn't really driving so much of a distance or change in people's relationship with technology, because they could understand it at an intellectual level, but emotionally within themselves and energetically, they had no way to sort of access themselves, so they needed technology. And once we started giving them practices to actually arrive into their body, they suddenly weren't as dependent on it.
That's very interesting. I might steal the stick idea. I work in a gym environment, and we always start with breath practices. And at first, and sometimes not just at first, but for many people, the few minutes of stillness is the toughest part of their day. And to have something more visual to rest their attention on like that, I could see that being a very powerful tool. And I could also make an argument that you're using that stick as technology.
Oh, 100% it is. Yeah. But the beauty of this is that it has one role. You know, I have a Casio alarm clock in my bedroom, and it's the same alarm clock that my stepfather used when I was growing up. And it's one of the best pieces of technology that I have, because it serves one role. It is a clock. I can set an alarm on it. It has no snooze button. It just needs a battery. It can travel with me. We contrast that to like the recent Apple advertisement, which got a lot of flack, which was where there was a piano and a violin and a mic and a compressor and a keyboard and paints, all of this. And it was in this hydraulic press that everything got compressed, and then out popped an iPad. And there's actually something that's sort of in, you know, it's paradoxical. On one side, it's so magnificent that all of these things can be compressed into one device. But on the other side, we sort of lose the reverence for the simple thing. Because people who use their phone as an alarm clock never chose for their phone to be their alarm clock. It just seemed like the natural thing to do, because why would I get an alarm clock when I have an alarm clock on my phone? But the unintended consequences of that is that when I roll over and I turn or snooze my phone, the alarm on my phone, I'm very likely to pour my attention and my energy straight into my phone at the start of the day. But if I just have a simple little alarm clock, it just serves its role. Just like the washing machine and the dishwasher do, they've come with one role. So does this stick. It's there to sort of anchor my attention. It's not going to pop up and suddenly, you know, foam my coffee or something like that. It's just going to be this stick. So I appreciate technologies like that come with a very simple and essential function.
That's fantastic. And I mean, I've mentioned this before. This comes out of a book that I base a lot of my training on. The book is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. It really taught me to view the body itself, the meat suit that we're in, as the technology itself and tried to use that to shape the day-to-day actions or behaviors, decisions, so that the body can provide more utility for whatever it is housing, the us that is inside. And that's why I've definitely used the, you mentioned like an access point. I've used like physical movement as such a primary access point to develop, you know, whether it's personal development or like just the self, the mind, however you want to use it, to connect inward as opposed to outward and let whatever unfolds from that process. Which I have to ask, I'm not used to seeing this on people's walls when I'm talking to them, but it looks like you have diagrams on the wall there of the human body. Why do you have those?
Oh,
do you, you must care about the physical practices to have those on your wall.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing to go to when I'm sort of exploring stuff in myself. So it's there. It's there as sort of my reference point. Instead of having to open up a book and look for stuff, it's a way to go there, and it's a way to observe what's actually happening in me or points. I've been doing a lot of, I've been training with this amazing guy, Luther Bryan, over the last few months using resistance stretching. And it's been incredible. It really, really, really has. So really what's happening there is that I'm contracting a muscle on one side so that I can lengthen it on the other. So the muscular system, I'm looking at that quite a bit in that case.
Gotcha.
A lot, you know, because therefore I'm not just focusing on the bicep, but I'm also aware of like what's happening on the opposing side on the tricep.
Gotcha. I'm sorry, I diverted it caught my attention. I'm subject to the same things you're trying to help people fix. I didn't mean to get the conversation off track there. I saw a flashy light.
No, it's great. I mean, I'm so happy to explore this wherever it's going, because I'm curious from your view, like what led you down the path of recognizing that a more mindful approach to movement was necessary?
Well, one, I don't know if it's necessary. I definitely prefer it. I mean, I would say necessary would be adding a level of judgment that, you know, I don't know if everybody needs to do things the way I do them, but I stumbled in it. I mean, I used to be super unhealthy back in the day, and then I started to get into exercise and started racing, foot races, running races, triathlons, and then my mother-in-law opened a Pilates and yoga studio, and I started taking yoga classes and really had no idea what I was getting myself into. And then had my like a glimpse of what it meant to go inward and, you know, work in as you would as opposed to work out. And at the end, you know, the instructor I was seeing would have some amount of somewhat traditional meditation practice within a class. And that was just an entryway into a totally different world. And then I just slowly incorporated those practices into my lifestyle. And then those practices allowed me to look at everything with a little bit different type of attention or more, I'd say, mindfulness, where I was paying attention to more aspects of all the things in my life, especially in the physical training, because that was a big part of my life, because I just enjoyed it and I really liked what it was doing for me from a health standpoint and how I felt. And then over time, altering my relationship with myself through those practices started to bleed outward into my relationships with my environment and other people in my life. And I felt like it just felt like it was serving me in a way that was the way that I ought to be going. And I just don't stop. I approach life with a bit of a curiosity of what can I learn next to help this process unfold and make this, you know, dance, this journey of life with a little more joy or fulfillment or meaning.
Beautiful.
Great sound.
And what's maybe the current experience or the current ways of moving that you're exploring?
Well, I've been physically, I spent like a decade and a half trying to learn everything I could that was interesting to me as far as like movement practices and different modalities and different tools. But over the last several years, I've settled on a fairly similar routine where I'm always kind of just slightly shifting the balance between different qualities, I guess, that I'm trying to cultivate. So I work backwards a little bit. I don't want to hijack this a little bit, but I work backwards thinking from the goal. And I find for me, the goal, and I think most people share a very similar goal, unless they have a highly specific situation, like they're trying to make the NBA or something. But most people ultimately want to be able to go out on their own terms in some degree, like dodge the nursing home. So when I analyze what qualities that need to be cultivated to do that, there's certain qualities that rise to the top. So for instance, strength might be a quality. To me, competency and strength are like the most important qualities to be practicing so that the meat suit can provide that utility to stay out of the nursing home, if you will. There's a lot of other qualities that are useful and great, and there's overlap between all the qualities. Like it requires, even though you're stationary, are you sitting down or standing up?
I'm standing.
So even though you're just standing relatively still, there's a strength component to that. You have to, and there's a competency. You have the ground, you have these parameters, you have ground, you have space, you have three planes, you have gravity, and you have the internal parameters of your body, your structures, your two legs, one trunk, two arms, one neck, one head, whatever. And you have to organize that in a way to keep you standing. And you have to organize the generation of the force that you're creating down into the earth so the earth pushes back and can hold you there. So there's a competency or movement efficiency or how good you move, how well you move would refer to like, how well do you do that? Do you compensate a lot? Do you do that? Do you have to hold your breath to stand up? Do you have to squeeze a muscle and have your nervous system on edge just to hold that position? Or is it simple for you? Is it efficient process? So that's a really important thing. And strength, even though you don't need a lot of strength for the demands that we have these days in life, because life is somewhat easy for us these days, for most people, you need a certain amount to stay out of the nursing home. So those two qualities are the things that I spend a lot of time with. And then you could cultivate those through all kinds of ways, different modalities, different tools. It could be the ground with no equipment. It could be a kettlebell. It could be, you know, yoga mat. It could be the stick that you showed me. I'll just shift. So I'll shift where I'm spending maybe a little bit more time on one of those qualities relative to the other, or a little bit more time. Like right now, the weather's nice in the morning, so I'm doing a little bit more of like general movement practice, exploratory movement practice mixed with a little yoga in the sun, barefoot, outside. And in the winter, when there won't be any much sun, I might spend a little more time with a barbell in the gym. And fall and spring, it might be a little bit more mixed with a little more kettlebell or explosive work. Or that's kind of how I look at it. I could go on for a long time about movements, and I already feel like I've hijacked your interview a little too much.
Oh, I love a dialogue. So I love the openness of us not necessarily knowing where this is going. And I think that's a nice contributive factor to the listener too. So I certainly don't feel as if I'm meant to be the one holding or filling all the space, you know, we're both here together.
Appreciate your listening, Patrick. I would like to bring it back to the ideas, the concepts around attention and focus and distraction, and I guess the role of these concepts in our lives, because they definitely seem to serve a purpose, and there have, you know, some of these things that we could label as negative or in our way are useful, and also they could be a great obstacle, especially with the availability with technology and how easy it is to, like you said, hit your alarm clock on your phone and be invited to check your email or whatever, or fall down a rabbit hole on Twitter or X or whatever.
So the curiosity is like how these things are impacting attention.
Yeah, like the interplay between, I mean, you mentioned you went from basically teaching speed reading, which is, you know, getting someone to focus on something, to realizing that you were having trouble with the same aspects of your focus, and now you clearly value the fact that you have a alarm clock that was not made recently, for the reason to almost create a boundary of some sort, or like to protect yourself from the from falling into what technology is kind of trying, or society or culture is trying to get, which is your attention.
Yes, I think there's the word boundary is interesting that you bring up. But maybe even before we get to boundary, another thing to explore is rhythm and pace. You're in Maryland, so I imagine, or when's the last time you were in New York City?
I try to avoid there. I went there probably 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm very comfortable never going back.
Why is that? What does New York...
The rhythm and pace. it's too much. I find it very stressful. Like, just you get off the train, you go outside, and it's immediate stress. I don't trust myself to be able to manage my nervous system to a point where I can enjoy being in that city.
So there's a guy, he was a photographer for the New York Times. We used to run together in New York when I lived there, but he primarily was doing work and shoots in different countries in Africa. He lived in Uganda. He kind of split his time between the two. His daughter was in New York, so we would have to come back to New York quite often. I asked him about the difference between both places, and he said, Uganda feeds me and I have to feed New York. He said that's the way the dynamic lives between the two. And we spoke about how if you try and maintain a very calm and composed energy in the city, you can do it for a while, but eventually the environment will overpower you and you will just end up sort of giving in to the pace and the rhythm of the place, because it's very hard to be submerged in this sort of environment, the system, and to try and constantly want to go against it. Equally, if you're in a very calm place, I feel very blessed to be here in Santa Fe in New Mexico. It cultivates and creates a certain pace and ease where when I connect with people who are in the city, or I even try and plug into that energy, I'm sort of brought back to this very kind of calmer pace of things. But it was very hard for me to cultivate that when I was back living in New York at the end of last year. So I say this because the very nature of the tools that we use today are all based on speed of transmission, the faster that things can move. And we feel that. We feel how the culture changes at warp speed. And internally, it does that with us as well. So there's a magic to that, because that's been one of the things that was so difficult, that there was barriers to information, things moved slower, we'd like them to move faster. Now they all move very fast. You could be fooling yourself if you think that you can engage with the tool of technology in a sort of mindful way. A lot of people will say this to me about, after hearing you speak, I'm going to engage with Instagram in a mindful way. Very good, try it. But the system of Instagram, the conditions of how it was built, well, maybe you'll be able to be mindful for a day or two. But it's a lot of energy and it's a lot of attention to try and say, this is the very nature of this thing, but I'm going to try and go another way. It's sort of like if you live in a family environment and there's a lot of chaos and fighting and tension. Yeah, for staying there for 5 days, you can hold your own center if you're really intentional about it, not get caught up. But eventually, the sort of the energy of the environment will suck you up. So that's one thing to consider, that what that does is it changes our internal state. Now, boundary. We come to the next point of boundary lines. Here I am speaking to you and I can see myself on the screen. I can see you on the screen. That is not me, the very person that I'm pointing at, nor is it you that I can see. It's an extension of you. It's a compressed version of you. This camera and this screen doesn't have the bandwidth to share all of you. I can't get the scent of you. I can't see the full shape of you in proportion. I can't feel what it's like to be in your presence. There's bits that I can get, but it's a more compressed that has less context. So it's an extension of me. It's not me. But it's very easy for us to forget that these virtual extensions, whether it exists on LinkedIn or on my email or on YouTube or on Instagram or on my text messaging or in Snapchat, it's very easy for me to forget that that's just an extension. It's very easy for me to start thinking that that's the real me. So I liken this to the Tamagotchi, where the Tamagotchi was this really pixelated pet, digital pet that was very common probably 20 years ago. And it's remarkable to think about how much meaning children were able to give to this very pixelated pet. schools started blocking it because kids would be checking it all the time because you had to feed it and water it every 30 minutes to keep it alive or else it would die. And kids would be crying once their Tamagotchi died, this pixelated pet that was like that. It had no color. It was just these gray pixels. Sometimes this school banned it and they would give it their parents while their parents were at work to check in on it, to feed it and water it. Imagine that we're able to place that much meaning onto something which was so inhuman or non-sentient, really, in what its being was. Now that we get like a visual extension of ourselves, which looks like us, and sometimes with filters and everything, it looks like a better version of us, it's easy for us to actually end up giving more meaning, credence, more of our identity towards the extensions of ourselves than the real, what do you call it, a flesh suit or something like that you're referring to it as? Meat suit, yeah. It's a very enticing way to call our bodies. It's this meat suit. So these two things coming in together, the fact that I lose a sense of who I really am because I think that I'm the virtual extensions of myself, therefore I lose the boundary of what this really is. I start thinking that I am all of the ways and means that people are interacting with me online. I am the way that I'm being seen and perceived online. Or I am not worthy because I am not online and I am not being seen by enough people. I'm only being seen by people in this physical space. So that starts to confuse the boundary line between where I begin and where I end. And when we lose a boundary of who we are, then it becomes very confusing because we're open to persuasion and influence very easily. And then the second thing is that we find it hard to move in and out of different rhythms. It's very helpful to be able to move in and out of different rhythms. It's why heart rate variability is one of the key indicators of health. How much can there be variance in the heart rate so that it's not some sort of flat baseline? For many people, they maintain a baseline, but the baseline is a very increased tempo of living. So even if they're living in a city or if they're in an urban area, if they're on the screen all the time, constantly messaging, sending things, going through reels, going through TikTok, there's this hugely fast tempo. And when the tempo slows down, they feel very uncomfortable. So they don't know what to do in this lower tempo. So they just go back to reintroducing something that's quick. And all of that creates all of this disorientation internally in our internal state. And if you don't have control over your internal state, you definitely don't have control over your attention. If you don't have control over your attention, it's impossible to focus it on a single point. If you can't focus it on a single point, you can't engage in concentration. So those things have a trickle-down effect. So if you're struggling with the ability to actually engage and stay focused on something, it's probably because you don't actually have control over your attention of where to direct it. If you don't have that agency, it's because you're not in touch with your internal state. You're more so being shaped and influenced by the external things which are driving you.
That's a very interesting description of that process. Other than balancing a stick on your hand to rest your attention on, what are other tools or strategies you recommend people exploring if they want to not optimize, but move their ability to focus or rest their attention on a desirable thing and maintain those boundaries in, I don't know, a more healthy or desirable way?
So within HARA, some very like basic fundamental things that we start with, because the journey that we're trying to move towards with each person is that what they're doing feels aligned. So it's not like there's a work bucket and a life bucket and a family bucket and all of these buckets that I have to keep tending to. And then where am I amongst all of that? No, we want to create like everything, the work that you're doing, the path that you're taking, the way that you wish to be with your family, that all of these things can be aligned together, because we're actually living in a time where we have so much leverage when it comes to business. We do have the capabilities and the opportunities to do very little administrative work, pour ourselves into the stuff that we really enjoy, and work with incredible people. It's all available to us. The barrier to get there is our own internal state. It's our own internal conditions. The challenges that we're facing are not external challenges. They're internal challenges. We're struggling with the overwhelming abundance of choice and ways and means of engagement. My mum, the environment she grew up in, all of the challenges were challenges of scarcity. She didn't have the qualifications. There were gatekeepers in the industries that she wanted to work in, all sorts of things. It was slow and hard to connect with people to build networks. Just in a two generations, it's all shifted in the opposite way, where now it's about, I have so many paths I can take. How do I discern and get clarity of that? This is what I want and this is what I'm going to pursue. So all that being said, that the practices that we implement are to start building foundational layers that can bring you to a point where you can start actually engaging in that, to start moving towards that space. So when people come into Harrow, we need to build those core foundations. So in the morning, a simple practice is the stick. If you get it on your fingers and it works, then we can put it on your wrist and we can do that for a while. After that, it's a balancing practice, shifting your weight from one foot to another. Our balance is so mediated by our eyes. So if I'm standing on my left foot and I start turning my head around as I'm standing on my foot, it will start to disrupt my balance. So what it does is it forces me to feel the anchoring on the left side of my body. How can I feel this sort of line of stability? It's an incredible way to start bringing your awareness and your attention inward. So you start feeling things inside of yourself. We have a few different balancing practices of our feet like that. And the aim is just to keep moving towards the edge of our capability. You know, then you can get to a point where you're trying to balance on one leg with your eyes closed and shifting your gaze. And that's really hard because then you really have to start feeling what's going on inside. Skipping as well in the morning to create some buoyancy in the body. For many people that I meet, their body is actually quite stiff. It's not buoyant enough. So we need to create some sort of elasticity in the fascial tissue because that will allow energy to move. It'll create more aliveness. Then throughout the day, one of the biggest challenges that people face is that they spend a lot of time on this medium-sized screen, but then to take a break, they'll shift to the small screen. So what they're doing is they're, first of all, they're allowing themselves to mentally check out, but their eyes are narrowing. And as the eyes narrow, it is a signaling system for focus and engagement. So we're not actually relaxing the nervous system. We're heightening it, but mentally we're checked out. So we're feeling like we're not mentally involved, but we're not actually relaxing ourselves internally. So we teach people how to juggle. Once again, two balls, three balls, then juggling off the ground. Keep going to the edge of your capability. And what that does is that gives people 30 seconds here, 45 seconds there, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there. I just have something to engage with. And it's actually relaxing, it's calming, and it's developing a certain quality of mind. I am engaged in one thing. If the balls drop, it's either because I don't have the coordination or it's because my mind went somewhere else and I'm brought back to the process. And at the end of the day, we have a shaking practice. So to shake a lot of the tension out of the body, to release a lot of the weight that we carry. You do that for 3-4 weeks. Suddenly there's a solid foundation. And then we can start like looking at what are the qualities that need to be developed in you? Are they mental qualities? Are they emotional qualities? Are they sort of pragmatic and practical qualities? Now I can draw from all the other experiences that I've had in developing those skills and qualities in people, and we can start implementing them. But because your internal state is now stable, if it's not stable, I can give you all sorts of stuff, but it won't last for 2 days because you'll just be brought back to the sort of manic chaos of what's happening inside.
That sounds like a fantastic process. Is this in person? Is this online?
So we are gathered online and there's the community space and we show up weekly and engage in calls and dialogues, whether there's questions and answers or just developing our awareness of things. And then every quarter we meet up in person for those who are able to join. And then
cool. Where are those meetups?
In Santa Fe. So here in New Mexico. So then we can go deeper into whatever is necessary, really, you know?
Are those like one-day events? How long are the meetups, the in-person meetups?
Weekend events. So from like a Thursday evening till a Sunday.
And then how long is the whole program? Or is it just an ongoing?
Well, it's not necessarily a program. This is the intent, that it's not like we're trying to take you from A to B. Each person has their own journey and path. So it's more about creating, you know, there was in the age of like the Enlightenment, or in the time of Benjamin Franklin, or in the times of the Renaissance, there were these guilds of people who came together because they wanted to develop certain qualities, they wanted to share ideas. So it's more so about how long do you want to be in this for? You know, do you just want to get to another threshold to make improvements in yourself? So maybe you'll be with us for 6 months or a year. Maybe you recognize that all of the efforts that you're making to be an entrepreneur are because you recognize that there's something much more deep and significant in your being, and you want to align your outward efforts with internal efforts, and you want it all to be moving towards the same direction. So for that, maybe we'll be on a journey together for quite a few years. So it's all dependent on what the individual wants, really.
That sounds like a cool system you're setting up or have set up. You mentioned, so you start with like kind of a physical on-ramp to manage the nervous system, which is great. And I love the idea of the shaking. I feel like shaking is one of those overlooked, underrated activities people could take part in. And then it leads to like mental or emotional qualities that you could identify that you want to like cultivate. Can you elaborate on the emotional qualities? What are the things you find yourselves working with people on in that realm?
So there was a gentleman who I had a sort of like an onboarding call with earlier this week. And I asked him, it just seemed to be a relevant question. If you were able to look outside of yourself as a third party, let's just call the gentleman John. So you were able to look outside of John as a third party. What does John's life orbit around? Money and power is what he told me. So as we started getting into it, I asked him lots of questions over the next hour or so. Words like recognition, legacy, bigger, acknowledgement, to be known, to be remembered. All of those things were there. Now, this gentleman is not short of money. I mean, it's all relative in terms of if you're short of power or not. It's about what you want. But as we dug into it, those driving forces were to compensate for experiences in his childhood. He had a very tough upbringing, and he wasn't acknowledged. He wasn't acknowledged much by his mother or his father at all. Now, he's wearing himself out. Like, his sole modus operandi at the moment is more money and more power. Now, within that narrative is because that will take me to, that will give me, I will arrive and I will experience. But really, once we got towards the end of the call, he wanted to be able to love himself more. So what happens if we start allowing that to be something that's cultivated in him, and he has all of these incredible capabilities within himself? He knows how to run a team. He knows how to grow a business. He knows how to build and acquire wealth. He knows how to help and support people. But it's orbiting around something which is very self-limiting, because there's always going to be somebody in the room who has more money and power than you. So if you're going to operate on that way, it's a mental thing. It's always going to be comparative. You'll never be satisfied. My sister was a model for a long time, and she told me that models are the most insecure people, because nobody wants to know about what's happening inside them. They're only being judged and observed externally. So whenever you walk into a room, you're aware of your own insecurities about your external qualities, and then you're only noticing, oh, well, she has nicer lips than I do. She's got a smaller nose. Look at her waist. Because you're looking at all the things that you don't have. So these people who are, you know, the top 1% in the genetic lottery and what they've got, and others are looking at them thinking, God, if only I could look like that. Yet internally for them, they're thinking, if only I could look like that. And it's a never-ending pursuit, because there's been no efforts of self-acceptance. So in the case of him, let's see what will it look like over the next 6 months. I think it's going to be really interesting. I think the work that he will do will be much more significant. I think it will be much more fulfilling. I'm sure it will actually generate more wealth for him in a way that feels more aligned. And he'll start to see that his work is taking him towards the person that he wants to be, as opposed to just it providing some series of riches that then he will feel complete, which is a story that we tell ourselves, but it's never true. So that's just a case of one individual, but it's always case dependent on what's happening with each person and what's really going on in them. Because we must sink many layers beneath the story that we tell everybody else. That's the acceptable social story that we tell. The reality is often very different.
Right. And I would assume that the reality that you find is very common, that it's born out of some personality trait that they created to help them survive some type of earlier, like early childhood or some type of childhood experience that probably served them very well at the time when the goal was to find a way to survive. And now those qualities as adult don't necessarily serve the same purpose and could be on some level an obstruction, and could get you to be doing things, like you said, for the wrong reasons, but for reasons that don't align with what you want those reasons to be.
100%. And, you know, we can map this so interestingly to reading, Les. So when we learn how to read, we're drawing on different, because nobody inherently can just read from birth. We we are given access to speech, we are given access to hearing, we are given access to singing, but reading is sort of like is a combination of these things. So it's a combination of our vocal qualities, of our capacity to hear, of our sight, sort of they blend together to create this reading capacity. So when you're a child and learning how to read, you're drawing these things together, these disparate parts to create this sort of core skill of reading. So you're learning how to say the word. So puncture. I'm learning how to say the word, the wheel is punctured. So I'm making sure I'm saying it aloud so that I'm pronouncing the words properly, because the teacher or our parent wants to make sure that we can enunciate correctly. Then I am also slowing down because I'm trying to think, the wheel is punctured. I'm learning the syntax of how these words come together to form a deeper meaning in how they're structured and how something is structured correctly or incorrectly. So what that creates is it creates this fixation on each word, the way that we end up looking at each word, because it's necessary as a child. It also creates this vocalization, because we have to vocalize each word as we're learning how to read so that we can affirm to ourselves that we're saying it correctly and show to others, elders who are teaching us. What happens from that then is that we end up reading in this very sort of fixed way, and we end up feeling the need to vocalize everything that we're reading internally. Great. Takes us all the way up to our early adolescence. But at some point, we don't need that approach to reading anymore, because the fundamental skill of reading is in the system. We need to move beyond the fixation, and we need to let go of the sub-vocalization, because those are the things that are holding us back. They're the weights now. We can actually end up reading faster. We don't need to read everything quickly. Sometimes we need to read slowly. Sometimes we just need to try and scrape a core bit of information. Sometimes we need to look out for patterns, and each way is calling on a different way of approaching the material of reading. So what we need is flexibility. And to get that flexibility, we need to let go of those core habits that we learned as a young child. And we need to learn how to approach reading from different angles and perspectives. So what you find then is that we learn one habit at one stage in our life, which serves us to ramp us up to a certain point. Then we have to come back and revisit it, let it go, because it lives in us. And now we have to try and create more variance in how we do the thing. That happens in everything. That happens in how we approach business. That happens in how we develop ourselves. It's this constant iteration of developing a certain quality, getting it to a certain point, then releasing it, creating variance in it. Because if you arise to a certain point and, you know, you complain that you're a bad reader, you're not a bad reader. You just haven't let go of the habits that you learned when you were 4 years old. If you could let go of those habits that you learned at four, we can mature your reading quality. And that can happen in all facets of things.
That's an interesting analogy coming from someone that used to teach speed reading. It makes me think of my reading capabilities. And I have a history of, I guess, being a little, I wouldn't say insecure, but never felt really good about my ability to read well. And I think I avoided it because of it. And now I just compensate with Audible. And I tell myself stories about why it's better. And in some ways, you know, I make a reasonable case for that. I can read while I take a walk in nature or whatever, or while I'm cooking dinner, and I could, you know, be productive. The American way, be productive.
I had a business partner who at 40, I shared these things with her. She's an incredible woman. Was the CEO of many different organizations, but she didn't really read because I don't know if she was ever diagnosed with dyslexia, but I think she had said to me that she was dyslexic, that she couldn't really read or finish books, so she would just get them on Audible and listen to them. But yeah, once I brought her through the process of just what we're talking about, letting go of the old habits and developing new ones, one day she sent me a photo and she said, "You have no idea how much joy this brings me. I've just read 5 books in the last 2 months." And it was sitting on her windowsill. And that was so beautiful to receive that, because that's the thing that we're talking about. She was not deficient in the moment. She just was still holding on to old ways which weren't serving her in this time. And that was the case for me as well. I went in to explore this stuff because I saw all these books that I read 2 chapters of and then didn't seem to go any further in them. And it was like the books that were in my apartment were like an indication of my my weaknesses and my ineptitude. So I thought, I want to figure out how to approach this. There was a guy I worked with who introduced me to the whole concept of speed reading. But the thing that it opened up in me was that it wasn't so much about reading quickly. That's not so endearing to me. If I need to turn it on, I can, but I just like it reading so I can read at a pace that's enjoyable. But what it really turned on to me was this idea of observing, how am I doing things? And is it the way that it needs to be done in this period of time? Or is it just the way that I always did it? And are there parts that I need to let go of? And are there parts that I need to add in to develop? Because that creates a real like constant journey of learning, and it allows curiosity to live in everything that we're doing, whether it's cooking or how we tend to our home or how we run our businesses or how we relate to our partners. You know, the way that I have always done things is not my identity. It's just the way that I've always done things. I can change it to align with the identity that I want to have at this moment in time.
It's funny. This feels hyper relevant to me. I have a pretty long stretch right now where I haven't read any books. And even I've bailed on a couple audiobooks recently because I had attention issues, which is like disturbing to me. But I have a podcast guest coming up in a few weeks, and he wrote a book and I'm interested, and I went to get it and I saw it wasn't on Audible book. It wasn't on Audible. It was just, you know, paperback. And I didn't freak out, but like I had a stress response because I want to read it prior to the conversation, and I'm like, oh shit, I have a mountain in front of me. I have something to face here.
I'll send you some videos, Les.
I have a strange habit. I mean, this is, you know, probably not interesting content, but like when I go to read things, my eyes jump around in such weird ways. I never seem to start at the top. My eyes have an automatic habit of going to like the second or third paragraph. And it's like a tick almost. Like I don't know how to control it. Like I would have to get ready before I turn the page. Like when I turn the page, I'm going to look at the first word of the next page. Like it's a weird automatic thing that just happens. And I don't know if that once served me. I don't know when it began, but it's something that I know I deal with.
Yeah, we'll give you some. There's the series of videos that I have, which I can share with you. They're hosted in Vimeo. And one of the drills is actually to train the eyes without any need to comprehend. So when people are trying to like think about a basketball player, they have to spend time working on their handling skills. They have to spend time working in the gym and their strength. They have to spend time working on their shooting. They have to spend time working on their endurance. And then all of those qualities come together on the court when they play a game, and it's what we see as the player. Similarly with reading, there's the speed in which we read, there's the comprehension, and there's the retention. And they're all sort of individual things which need to be developed individually so that when you approach a book to read, you know how to call on each faculty in the right way at that moment. So for the speed part, what we need to do is we need to let go of comprehension and retention, and we just need to train the eyes to move at different paces and rates across the page. Just like that, just almost as if it's like a drill, like an endurance drill, like doing sprints. Doing sprints and then doing like longer, slower paces. And what that does is that sort of now starts to build up new options in how you associate to looking at the words on the page instead of just engaging in this default habit, which just keeps repeating itself. But if you're trying to do that whilst also trying to read the text and understand it and try and store it, some of it, it's too many competing parts. So you can't focus on honing in on the one skill that needs to be developed at that time. So that's just a little kind of insight into how this is approached.
That sounds really interesting to me. That sounds like a well thought out, structured approach that sounds really beneficial. I would like to dip my toe in that.
Well, you'll dip us. I'll send the videos to you and you can do it.
I got you on it. We're over an hour here. What else is on your mind, Patrick, that you'd like to share about Hara, or things to point people to find out more? Or how else would you like to convey this message?
Yeah, I mean, the real effort here and the intention is to create an inner circle for exceptional people that want to live exceptional lives. So on the Hara website, you will see that it's titled as Self-Mastery for the Self-Made. So there's a real beauty in this journey of trying to cultivate the lives that we wish to live. But there's something even more special when we can feel that we're doing it amongst a group of people who share a similar view, that this is done for developing myself so that when I do arrive on my deathbed, I realize, wow, I really lived a full life in all the facets of my being. And I was also able to offer myself to those that I love and to be there and present for them. I wasn't chasing after superficial or synthetic identity-driven things. I was using these goals and these targets as a way to develop something inside of me. So that's what we're creating. And I'm looking to bring on people who fit into that, who are exceptional individuals who want to live exceptional lives, and they also want to be around others who are pursuing those. So Hara is the site, hara.co, for anybody who wants to check it out. What we can also do, if you're open to it, is for anybody who has an interest in joining and wants to schedule a call with me, we can put a Calendly link below so people can come and schedule a call and see if they're a fit to join and to be a part of this. And I'm doing this in many ways because I want to be around people like that. And I've seen the immense growth and joy that happens when we get to show up and speak sincerely and candidly with each other instead of trying to posture and present this sort of idealized version of ourselves. But instead, we sort of get to bring the reality. This is where I'm at. This is what I'm working through. This is what I'm trying to get toward. And I see that you're also doing the same and you're also doing the same. And yeah, it just creates a very wholesome way of approaching life and business.
That sounds fantastic. It sounds like you are creating the community that you yourself feel you need or what you are yearning for.
Yeah, definitely.
That is, what a beautiful way to take action. Well, yes, Patrick, we will definitely link to, the Calendly link if folks want to check out and schedule a discovery call to learn if it's a good fit for them. And I want to thank you, Patrick, for taking the time and thank you for reaching out to us. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Likewise.
And for the listeners out there, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you feel you know someone you think would also enjoy it, please send it their way. Patrick, thanks again, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Les. Thanks for having me. We'll be right back.